21st, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for Tangerine SDR. My name is Dave, KV0S. And this week, we've been having lots of conversations on the listserv. We've been busy with different kinds of development for myself. Dev?
Yes?
Could you put yours on mute when you're not talking? Thank you. I have added the license agreements to all the web pages. I have added some documentary explanation under the code section so that you have some idea what the different Git repositories have in them. So that's been done. I've been helping Dave with his magnetometer testing, and so that's been moving forward. So that's about it for me. Next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello, everyone. I hope you can hear me all right. I've been busy mostly sending emails back and forth to lots and lots of people. Trying to explain things as well as write code and hopefully even do a little documentation. But that's been keeping me pretty busy. That's probably it for right now. It's been an interesting week. You, Dave.
Well, fine business. Next on the list, we have Dev. Dev, can you give us a comment of your week?
So it's me?
Yes.
Thank you. So I have some music as my daughter is trying to sleep. So I try to speak with them. the topics under discussion in the thread and doing some literature reading, meditation. I'm, so to say. So I haven't done myself anything new, but I'm trying to learn.
Okay. You dropped out a little bit along the way. Something you may be interested in is under Tools, Options, Capture. There's the ability to turn your TeamSpeak session to either push to talk or VOX, and you're on VOX right now. So you can do it either way, but that way you can control when the audio goes out and not have it drop out on you.
Okay.
So I'm going to go down the list, and next on the list is Mike, AAAK, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak recordings to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next, we have N8WQ. I think that's Orville. Go ahead. You're mic muted, so I guess we aren't going to have your addition tonight. Next, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Good evening, Dave and the group. Things are going fine here. Just another week. I'm also reading and responding to all the emails on the listserv. There are quite a few of them. I think everything's going fine. It's a lot to keep track of. I could talk with Dave a little bit later just to make sure we know where things are going, because we had a lot of emails with him. I gave a talk last Thursday, to the Penn State Engineering Group. And that's one of the things that prompted me to put together that updated PowerPoint presentation, kind of summarizing the different parts of the project. So I now have that presentation put together, and I think things are coming along just fine. So other than that, I'm continuing to teach remotely and coordinate all sorts of research projects and keep going. So W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business. And Orville is still shown as mic muted. So then we go to Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone in the group. It's been a busy week. Let's see. First of all, I did some research into GPS limits. The group from the University of Houston wants to put a tangerine SDR in a balloon, and the altitude of the balloon used to cause GPS to terminate. It turns out, ultimately, that the GPS limits were changed about 5 or 6 years ago, and the one of the modules that John Ackerman's looking at adheres to the new requirements, and so it would be usable on a balloon at altitude. So that's good news. Secondly, I started looking at power consumption estimates for Tangerine SDR, because the balloon crew has a battery and they have a weight limit. I've estimated the maximum and the typical power consumption for the receiver and for the clock module. I don't have an estimate yet for the data engine. I was able to download the Intel Altera early power estimator spreadsheet for the FPGA that is planned to be used on the data engine, and would need some information to fill that out, but it should give us at least an estimate. I spent some time estimating the Raspberry Pi 4 idle, typical, and maximum power consumption, and it's quite a bit larger than the receiver and the clock, the data engine there, of course, being the unknown estimate. And then lastly, I got the XA12 schematic for the receiver from the layout guy, although the pagers are marked XA11. I think that was just an oversight where the revision was rolled, but the documents weren't updated. And as a result, I updated the interface control document for the receiver, and there were pretty substantial changes on it. But hopefully what's up on the tangerine.com website now is an accurate reflection of the receiver as it's laid out, and all the pin, jumper, switches, 0-ohm resistors, things like that are identified and described as to how you need them, set them to get it to what you want to do. And lastly, a lot of emails from the list and reading of papers, analyzing things, took a look at FL Digi and analyzed it to a small amount. So a lot of interesting topics. Back to the group, Dave.
Fine business. And next on the list, we have Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, hello there, Dave, and thanks again for running the show here. We really appreciate it, as well as Mike for recording and posting. Got diverted a little bit onto some old work this week. One of the good things that happened, though, is I now have high-speed internet. So we got cable installed at the house here. Even though everything was shut down, they were able to cable it up to the outside. So I crawled up in the attic, which was tremendous fun, and pulled the wire through and got it all connected up. So now we're running about 50 megabits down and about 3 megabits up, which really beats the pants off of 1.5 meg down and 0.7 meg up. So probably even support video now. See what else. I took a look at the some of the drawings going by there upon the RF board with Tom. I have a question for Tom. Did Dave actually fix the XA11? Because if he didn't, I'll go ahead and fix it, and we will have everything all finished up. And I think he fixed the silk screen. It looked good to me. If everything is good, then I think we can consider the RF board done, unless we actually need changes on the data engine. You know, the data engine requires changes on the RF board. So
Rob, I'm trying to turn it off. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. I know how hard it is when it's blaring at you to find the key. Anyway, the data engine should be going into CAD in about 2 weeks. There's a job that we have in front of it. Our CAD guy is working on that, so he has got to get his schedule cleared up, and then we'll be off to the races with the data engine and see if we can get a placement done pretty quick so we can see if there's any changes to the RF board. I hope there aren't any, because it looks really good the way it is. Tom's done a great job in reviewing and making sure that we don't do something dumb. So that's it. Back to you, Dave.
Well, fine business, Scotty, and congratulations. I was wondering if you had to climb that pole, but it sounds like not. Next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Have you avoided any tornadoes, Bill?
Oh, man, two weekends in a row, we dodged a bullet in each case. Last week, the tornado came between, we are 20 miles from Tuscaloosa, the home of the University of Alabama. Last week, a tornado came between us and and Tuscaloosa. And this past weekend, they just kind of skipped past us. But anyway, yeah, but we have the bunker, and anyway, so as far as work on our system that we're developing here, I worked this week on making something dynamic in the user interface so that according to the discussion we had last week, the small board computer will be able to query the data engine to say, okay, data engine, what data rates will you support? What sample rates? And I'm setting it up so that when the user goes to select channels, the user will see only the data rates that the data engine has already actually said that it will support. And so if there's a change in that, that will dynamically appear and become available in the Tangerine front end. We also had a nice discussion with the Case Western people in our science group on I guess it was on Thursday, and I please forgive me, gentlemen, that I am a little bit kind of beyond my depth as far as understanding all the details of how the data analysis with the Fourier transform works one way, and the discrete Fourier transform used by F.L. Dichy works a different way. And this is really not in my area of expertise. So we've had, I'm sure that everybody has seen several emails going past on the mailing list about this. And I requested to Tom if he could help us on one of our science team meetings, because I think it's important that we kind of figure out some of the trade-offs between the speed of data acquisition and the precision, that is, how tight we see, what level of precision we see on the data acquisition, as far as do you want to have it to 10 millihertz or 50 millihertz, or what is actually sufficient for the science team, and what can the data engine actually produce, given that this is not something we're designing for Hewlett-Packard, this is something we're designing for users, that's, you know, something that's going to be affordable. So, you know, I've been observing what happens with these signals that, for example, WWV, and the reality of it is that you get multiple refractions from WWV, and you may not necessarily have a signal that is precise within 10 millihertz or whatever. You have the signal splatters because you've got a whole bunch of different altitudes that are all refracting at the same time, and you're getting all the signals at the same time. So I'm a little bit concerned about this. I mean, obviously, we want to do something that's going to give the science community what they need, but we want to make sure that we commit to doing something that's actually achievable with actual hardware and software that's at the price point that we have. So I'm sorry for venting, but anyway, this has been a little bit the last couple of days of pulling out a little bit of hair, but we have the people on this team that can figure it out. So I'm just looking for guidance. Okay, that's the main thing. Channel. Please don't ask me to figure this out myself. I'm looking for guidance. So I'll pass it back to you, Dave. Thanks.
Fine business, Bill, and thanks for working on that so diligently. There's a couple of people that have jumped in that I want to catch before we go to open discussion. There's David N1HAC. Go ahead, David.
Good evening, all. Couple of things I wanted to just bring up quickly. One was the question about the ES limits, because as one who flies high altitude balloons above 100,000 feet, our understanding is that those limits are an and, that above 60,000 feet and faster than 1,000 miles per hour, I think it is, or feet per second, one or the other, is limited, but one or the other is not a limit. So I wanted to find out why that was causing trouble. It's 1,000 knots are the COCOM limits. We fly a garden variety, essentially Trimble GPS on our balloons, and we've never had a problem with those turning off above 60,000 feet. And the other thing is I've been in contact about the magnetometer tests and looking forward to getting hardware to work with on that one. So I guess that's it for me at the moment.
Okay, and then we had Rob, AI6VN. Go ahead, Rob.
Hello. I'm dropping in here. Just I don't really have a contribution. You know, I'm off working in my own world with the Whisper Demon and databasing and such. So I just thought I'd check in and make sure that you guys know I'm still interested. And I have, you know, we're starting to push the boundaries of what the Kiwis can measure. So we're looking forward to this tangerine. There's another device to be listening through. That's all.
Well, fine business, Rob. And I believe that brings us where everybody's had a chance for comments. So we're open for general discussion.
Yeah, this is Tom. Let me address the GPS limits. I talked to W2GPS, Rick Hambly, who's, you can tell by his call sign, he's sort of into GPS. He sent me an article, and it turns out that according to the article he sent, and my understanding is that up until 2014, the COCOM limits were the limits that applied, and they were 60,000 feet elevation, and there was a velocity, and some manufacturers interpreted that as an or, some as an and, that units manufactured to that point in time had those limits. But in 2014, the regulations were transferred from COCOM to ITAR, which is the U.S. International Trafficking and Arms and Regulation. And they loosened the limits to 50 kilometers altitude and some velocity. And that some GPS modules that you purchase still adhere to the old limits, but that newer GPS modules adhere to the newer, looser limits. Does that explain things?
Somewhat, except that... Yeah, as you say, some of the manufacturers did it as an or, not an and. It's supposed to be both above 60,000 feet and faster than 1,000 knots. It would turn off. It was supposed to limit missiles, but not anything else. But some of the manufacturers misunderstood those limits. But yeah, I wasn't aware that they had raised it. And of course, none of our balloons are going to go above 50,000. Kilometers, so that should take care of it.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I misspoke. 50,000 meters, 50 kilometers. Yeah, there were some manufacturer sheets and apparently that used the word or, and not everyone agreed that was right, but some did anyway. So apparently, depending on how old the receiver is that you purchase, it may, you know, still have the old limits wired into it, or it may have the new limits wired into it.
Yeah. Well, as I say, we haven't had a problem with that because we were using manufacturers who understood it to be an and. I guess it depends on who you get it from.
Very good. Scotty, briefly, the schematic that I got from Dave, the XA-12 schematic, is marked on the schematic pages as XA-11, and the revision table goes up through XA-11, and there's no XA-12 revision entry in the table, nor is the pages marked XA-12.
Okay, I need to fix that, because what he did is just change the, when he renumbered it, he just changed the revision. He didn't go back and fix the page revisions and the table. So Okay, I'll take care of that, and I will. We'll just go to XA13 and make that the Rev A. So that'll be the highest Rev XA, unless there's any more changes. Highest XA Rev, and that will be equivalent to Rev A. And then after we build the board, if we find any changes and we start making those, then it'll be XB1 and continue up from there. So that'll be the beginnings of Rev B, assuming we have one.
Okay, no problem. I assume that it was just a failure to mark and update the pages. So I went ahead and redid the ICD for the module with the assumption that that what Dave sent was the latest.
Yeah, I don't think anything else will change except those Rev numbers, and that won't make any difference to pretty much anyone but us.
Nathaniel is for the science team meeting. Bill asked me to join that. What is, do you get into that the same coordinates that we use for the Monday evening team speak, or is it some different way?
I think he's talking about the Case Western meeting. Is that right, Bill?
Yeah, it's the meeting with that we do. I think it's on Zoom, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's on Zoom on Thursdays at 10 a.m. I can add you, I can send you an invite to that.
Okay, I have, there is a science team meeting, which I thought was Thursday, April 30th at 3 p.m. Is this something different?
Yes, the one that's Thursday, April 30th at 3 p.m., that is going to be, yes, it's more of a science team meeting. It probably won't specifically address the questions you're looking at with the frequency estimation.
Okay, very good. Could you send me an email or something so I can figure out when and where it is?
Sure, no problem. I'll add you to this right now.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah, Nathaniel, forgive me. I don't mean to poke my nose in where it doesn't belong, but I think it's important that we try and align what we're designing here with the requirements, and now is the time to do it rather than later.
No, I completely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you. And the other thing is, I actually do want, you know, to get more coordination between what Case Western is doing and what the Tangerine people are doing, which you've probably seen from some of my emails on the listserv. I want there to be a good amount of coordination so that when things can share either hardware or software, and it makes sense they do so.
Absolutely. That's exactly what we should do. And in fact, I think it would be like a dereliction of duty if I can't figure out a way to make the Tangerine output something that is like go into Case Western Reserve emulation mode. And I believe that the Tangerine probably will have sufficient capacity that we could run Case Western system emulation mode in addition to all the other data acquisition we want to do.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's exactly what I've been pushing for all along. Because then the idea is you'll have one, at least for that one particular mode, you can have this one much larger unified network.
Yeah, and it will provide an excellent proof of concept when we can compare the output from the two different systems. I mean, comparing really brings a lot of, I don't know, it can lead to whole new discoveries. For example, I have been running all this afternoon on my Flex Radio FL Digi, frequency analysis approach, and observing what it does, and also at the same time in a different slice, but connected to the same frequency, observing the same signal from WWV using Spectrum Lab. And it's interesting that I don't see that they don't always line up. And so this is going to lead to some whole new discoveries, I think. Even if all we're discovering is the crappiness of our approach, I don't know. But anyway, more information on that as it develops.
Yeah, I agree with that. Now back to the science requirements in the mode. What are your big questions again right now?
Well, we have talked about how precise our frequency data needs to be. And there's this non-trivial trade-off between the precision of the frequency estimate and how long it takes to get the frequency estimate and which of the several different data analysis techniques you use. And those things are kind of all convolved together. And so I'm wanting to talk this out sooner rather than later with the people who understand both the science requirement and what the hardware can do, so that we make sure that we design something where we're going to produce the, what would you say, we can actually do what we're trying to do?
That's right. I agree. Okay, so right now we are, the way Case Western is doing things, from what I understand, is they are making 1 second measurements with 1 hertz resolution. Is that what I read on the listserv today?
That sounds right.
And the trade-off is that if we increase the integration time, this observation time to 100 seconds, then you can have, 0.01 hertz resolution?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, but that's by changing the algorithm from the nonlinear algorithm that Case is using to the linear algorithm that we were talking about doing in FFT.
No, it's very fundamental to time and frequency. If you want 0.01 hertz resolution, you need 100 second observation interval regardless of the algorithm.
So you're still going to be doing it in the time domain and in the nonlinear method?
Yeah, what the paper does is it provides a very efficient method for computing the frequency. And the way that it does is that, first of all, you gather the data and you do an FFT or a DFT. Mathematically, they're the same. An FFT is just has some efficiencies involved with it. But you figure out which bin the signal you want is in, and then you can apply the what the algorithm does is it derotates the frequency from the bin that you have the estimator from to kind of produce like a DC signal that drifts a little bit. And the algorithm allows you to efficiently keep up with the drift of that signal. But primary is you got to find the right bin to begin with. And that requires an FFT or a DFT of the size large enough to make sure you have the right bin.
So then it would take you if you wanted it down to 10 millihertz, you'd have to take the 100 seconds and do the FFT, pick your bin, and then you could apply this more strategic algorithm because you already know what you're looking for, sort of. And then you would be able to get quicker data points. Is that the idea?
The idea is computational efficiency. Once you have the estimator, then, for example, each second you could update your information about the frequency you're tracking with very few computer steps required. So the key idea there is it's a computational efficiency mechanism that's pretty good. I discussed with Bill a little bit offline. One of the key things that happens in looking at WWV is you get multiple different modes. You can have X and O modes. You can have double hop modes. There's a kind of a basket of modes there. And those are going to all be at different frequencies. And so, in fact, you may have to run more. Your estimator may produce 3 or 4 different valid answers simultaneously, and you have to figure out which bin each of those different modes is in and go track each of those independently.
Now, let me jump in here for a second. I can tell you the 1 hertz resolution makes me a little nervous. And I'm looking at the plot that Steve Ryer, WA9VNJ, left us a couple years ago. From his Eclipse WWV measurements. And I see, the excursions are, say, 0.3 hertz are some of the maximum heights on this graph here. And so I'm thinking 0.1 or 0.2 is actually a much better, I mean, just from looking at this figure, 0.1 or 0.2 hertz is much better. So that's point number one. And point number two, is it possible, there's a significant amount of information that is included in the raw spectrograms. So if we're able to, you know, keep the raw IQ data, even if it's for a fairly narrow bandwidth, say, like, I don't know, I'm looking again at Steve Serwin's presentation of a bandwidth of, you know, say even just a few hertz, 5 to 10 hertz, that can contain significant information that could help, you know, solve the puzzle of, you know, which propagation modes we're seeing.
Yeah, I agree with you, Nathaniel. The 1 hertz FL Digi has a 1 hertz bin. And so it's able to start this process in 1 second of time, because for 1 hertz resolution, you need a 1 second observation interval to compute the estimator. For 0.1 hertz, you need about 10 seconds of observation interval. And for 0.01, of course, 100 seconds. So the discussion was that if you want to achieve, you know, 10 or 100 millihertz resolution, it's going to require a 10 or 100 second data sample capture in order to compute the estimator, and then you can start tracking. And so that's kind of where this whole discussion started out.
Well, this kind of comes back to my original question, is what level of precision do we need to get the science out of this that we want? Because, you know, we can talk about 1 hertz resolution, which we're pretty sure is not good enough, because a lot of the excursion takes place considerably less than that. But the question is, are we able to, you know, it comes back to sample rate, because think about this. if you do do an acquisition for 100 seconds, the frequency is going to move around in that time frame, and what you're going to get is you're going to get something that is averaged over that time frame, which is okay if that meets the science requirements. I keep coming back to this. We need to understand what the science needs are, and then if the science needs are something that cannot be done with the hardware that we're designing, then we've got to re-examine our objectives.
Yeah, well, if I can say something.
Go ahead.
This is David, N1HAC. We're doing exactly this with AM broadcast carriers, and we're analyzing them down using a Raspberry Pi to 3/4 of a hertz bins. We can see multiple carriers within those bins. Now, what I don't know is what our time base is, how long each one of those FFEs is running for. But we're using it to pick up gravity waves in the ionosphere, and it's more than adequate to do that. So it really does. I'll look into exactly what our, how long we're doing an FFT for to get this resolution. But it does also come down to the science. What is the time scale that we want to see these variations at?
So I can tell you, for looking at gravity waves and the traveling ionospheric disturbances, which really is the main target for this sort of Doppler shift observation, those are going to have characteristic time scales of, you know, of typically 15 minutes or longer. So doing,
that's about what we're seeing. Yes,
right. And there is a characteristic frequency of the atmosphere called the Brunt-Weissele frequency, which is on the order of about 15 minutes. And so that's usually the frequency you're interested in. So with that in mind, you know, 100 second integration is not unreasonable. That's you know, one measurement every, one measurement every 2 minutes or less than every 2 minutes. And so I think that's quite reasonable to get that finer frequency resolution. Now, the other thing we should keep in mind, though, too, is that we should have the ability to, if we want to switch modes, if we decide for a different science target, we would like to see have a faster update rate at the expense of the frequency resolution. We should have the ability to command the system to do that, because sometimes the science targets change over time. Today, we want to look at traveling ionospheric disturbances generated by gravity waves that have, 15-minute or longer time periods. But tomorrow, we might want to look at, some other thing that has a faster scintillation or a faster cadence. But we decide that we don't need the same level of frequency resolution. So we should be able to switch. But for now, our main target, I think, should be the gravity waves.
Nathaniel, what about the case where if we're taking a measurement over 100 seconds and the frequency shift changes during that time?
Well, that's, that will be okay. Remember, so what I was saying is that with these gravity waves, if you have them moving in if you have them moving at time scales of about 15 minutes, the frequency shift probably, that averaging is going to be okay if you are trying to look at these things that have longer time scales.
Okay, because it's moving so slowly. But
right,
it seems exactly. Like when Bill put his, was it Bill, I think, or John, put his data up at the last Thursday meeting, it seemed like there were things that changed rapidly, more rapidly than that.
Yeah, and there are those things too, but again, it depends which science target you're going for. And we won't be able to go for every science target all at the same time. We're going to have to make these trade-offs.
Yeah, the point I think perhaps being overlooked, and I think Nathaniel has it correct, is that if the frequency of a waveform changes over the observation interval, and you're looking for accuracies on the order of 0.01 hertz, or that kind of a bin size, and your frequency is changing faster than that, you really don't have a definition of what frequency means, because at part of it it's faster, at part of it it's slower, but you can't really describe accurately what that frequency is. The problem is one of, if you're trying to distinguish between two frequencies in adjacent 0.01 hertz bins, and your observation interval is a second, you just have a few degrees of the waveform that you're looking at. And in any kind of noise or any kind of multiple signal, your ability to accurately describe the frequency from just a few degrees of the waveform is practically nil.
So what you're saying is it's really just a phase difference then, not really a frequency difference, because it's a fraction of a cycle.
Well, you have a curve, right? And you're trying to describe an entire cycle of a curve based upon just a couple points on the curve. So you have to extrapolate before and after, see where the zero crossings are, and see, how close they are or are not. And if you have just a tiny bit of a waveform, you can't accurately make that estimation.
And now, part of Bill, back to you for a second. Is it feasible for you to implement the mode in such a way that we say that you give us some sort of performance curve? You can tell us if you want 1 second integration, you get 0.0, you get 1 hertz resolution. If you do 100 second integration, you get 0.01 hertz resolution. And knowing that curve, can we set the whole network to operate in one of those two or three or whatever different modes, depending on the need?
Well, sure. If we design the thing up front to be able to do that, I'm sure that we can achieve that. I mean, because this topic has come up, I sat here and watched WWV this afternoon, and from the QTH here in Central Alabama, along with
There is
GPS-DO frequency a couple of hertz away and observing how it changes over time. And I can see that there are multiple signals being reflected or refracted from the ionosphere. So part of it is deciding which one you want to look at and decide that, oh, that's the one I want to track. And as Tom mentioned, you have the, you know, ordinary, extraordinary, and multiple hops. And not only that, but you got multipath. So it's this a non-trivial question that we're looking at here. If we can describe what it is that we want to observe, we can certainly develop something that can observe it. We just have to make sure that we are pretty careful about what we describe. Go ahead.
Well, I think one of the problems that we're facing, Bill, is that we actually are still, we don't know exactly which of those traces we want yet. And that's, you know, Steve Serwin was talking about that at the meeting at the last TAMSAI Telecon. And actually, this might be something when Steve Serwin comes back and gives his presentation at one of the 3 p.m. meetings, Tom, you might want to attend that. Like Steve Serwin has been trying to figure out, okay, what does it mean when you have one hop, when you see these multiple traces there? How do you sort that out? How do you separate out WWV from WWVH? Not all of that is understood yet, and that's still something that's under investigation. So I don't think we are really in a position to say this is the best way to estimate this. That's why I think for the tangerine SDR, it's actually... You know, and actually this might be something even the low cost system can do, even at baseband, the way they're combining things. If we're able to, you know, just retain the raw IQ data so that we can reprocess things afterward with a few different methods, or look at these, you know, raw spectrograms for later analysis, I think that's what we need to be able to do. Until we can, you know, figure out how to sort some of things out, these things out, because I just don't think we really understand what we're looking at yet and how to process it.
Yeah. Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about. and one of the things you got to remember is that when a signal bounces off the ionosphere, it's not bouncing off a solid plane; it's being refracted through a volume. So you got a three space up there. That's giving you back a smeared out range of stuff that's coming down. And so you've got so many, I don't know how many kilometers of ionosphere that is in this refractive condition. And so you're going to get a smeared out a combination of things, and you got to figure out what it is you want to look for. And most certainly we can set the system up so that you can retain a big chunk of the data, you know, the data between, you know, plus and minus a few hertz from the target frequency, all of that. And then you can run some algorithm to extract something like the strongest signal in that band and gives you a close look. But then in addition to that, you have the ability to look at the other modes or the other combinations of things. I see that Tom... tried to transmit about the same time I did. So you take it, Tom. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's okay. You've got it, Bill.
Yeah, I'll also point out that it's probably bouncing off multiple layers. And we're seeing this in the AM broadcast band. And that's what I'm trying to share, is that we're actually doing this real-time, taking continuous data in hertz. Actually, the actual data is wider than that. We just display 3/4 of a hertz of it. I'm not the one who did the programming, but files. And it may be helpful for us to share the program that we've done for looking at these. And yes, especially at dawn and dusk, in multiple ways. And we may actually want to have something that looks for this dispersion and records a resolution data during these periods so we can go back and look at it.
Yeah, I agree. Be able to store that higher resolution data, you know, so you can produce those full spectrograms. I think that's really good. I think, yeah, Bill, I think for the moment, what we have right now is using one of the things too to remember is that even though the measurement technique that FLDigi and that Case Western is implementing, even though it may be imperfect and it's not capturing everything, it still is capturing useful information at that macroscopic scale. And, you know, we could see that when Case Western presented the results at the HAMSCI workshop, they were able to show a movie of the Doppler shift observations made with this algorithm. And you could very much see day-night transitions, and you could see them move with season when they played the movie, and you could see a lot of patterns in there that are clearly like geophysically created. So we know that as imperfect as it is, that summary estimation that they are calculating does include some useful information. Now, as we learn more, so as people like Steve Serwin go through and as Case Western, you know, studies this further, I think we will be able to come up with a better frequency estimation and improve it over time. But I think right now that the approach of being able to store that raw IQ data for each of the individual slice bands, even if it's just a few hertz wide, and also be able to calculate that summary frequency estimation, doing those two things in tandem, I think it's useful, and I think it's a way forward to figuring out what really needs to be done.
I want to jump in here for a minute. We do have a new member that just added, John N8OBJ, who is from Case Western, so he may want to chime in on some of this.
Yeah, I just finally got the password and things working. Can everybody hear me?
Yep, you're coming through fine.
Okay, I was hoping to get in on the meeting about 45 minutes ago, but technical difficulties. What I did over this past weekend is I did a test using that nonlinear algorithm that David Kasdan was explaining, only I did a from antenna jack to output file test. It was the entire system test, and I was able to inject a signal and start decreasing the amplitude down from 200, set it out at 200 microvolts input to the antenna jack, and I took it down to 500 nanovolts and was watching the ability of this algorithm to capture the exact frequency. And I'm in the process of creating a report. I'm going to publish it to the whole Tangerine SDR list, but I've got information that shows what we've implemented in my very, very simple radio and the results I'm getting with a known stimulus on the input. Now, this does not include noise. This is a raw function of the entire system as a complete system, not just the algorithm. So that may prove to be useful for future discussions. Over.
Yeah, hey, John, I haven't had a chance to read. I wanted to request that if you could use PTT instead of Vox, it would. If you could figure that out. I know there's too many options on this program.
Tools, options, capture, push to talk.
Let's see, sound capture? No.
You on a Mac or a Windows?
Right now I'm on a Windows system.
Okay.
So it should be tools at the very top, and then the options is the very bottom selection on my Windows system. And then you get a huge big panel of selections, and you want to go to the capture tab on the left.
Got it.
One down.
Okay.
And you want to select push to talk, and then I use the right alt key. You don't want to use any repeating key like a space bar or anything like that. And then you want to make sure you turn on the echo reduction and advanced options, and do not check voice activation detection while using PTT. I'm having a lot of trouble here. Maybe I'm just a CW op instead of a phone op. I see a lot of people cutting out every other syllable, and I just have a tough time understanding them. So I'm a big fan of PTT. Talk when you want to talk when the button's pushed.
Okay, I think I've got it now. Over.
Okay.
Beauty. Thanks, John. Anyway, I had a question on the software that they're using. Basically, they're doing an analog mixing down to baseband, and then they're processing baseband data. So I don't see really how this is going to be any different than us digitally mixing down baseband data to baseband and then feeding it to the single board computer. So correct me if I'm wrong, if there's some magic in there, but I think, doesn't the Pi process baseband audio?
Basically what we're doing is I've got my modified version of FL Digi sucking the audio stream coming from the mixing or the output of my little radio, which we have the GPS DO tuned to a kilohertz below the WWV frequency. So when we mix it, we get a 1 kilohertz tone, which is what goes into the FL Digi, and we use the analysis package in there to look to see how far off 1 kilohertz it is.
Okay, because that was what I was going to suggest, is that if we have a highly stable oscillator on the tangerine, we could actually shift the each WWV frequency to a standard frequency, like say 1 megahertz, and then mix it with 0.999 megahertz or 99999, whatever, 1 hertz off, and then send the result out. And basically it's going to be, you're going to be getting the same exact thing in IQ data from the data stream that you would be getting in the analog data stream on the low cost PSWS.
Definitely a possibility, and definitely want to talk to you about that. Because right now, the expensive piece of my whole setup is the Leo Bodnar's GPS discipline oscillator. It's like $100, and that blows me out of the water for my $100 price point.
Well, unfortunately, I don't have any magic way to get you a high-precision GPS for no money.
Yeah, I'm finding that one out pretty hard way yet, but... Yes, that's basically what we're doing, but the nonlinear algorithm locks in pretty quick, and it's pretty impressive. Like I say, I'll send the plots out, because I was doing, you know, decade levels down, and I'm pretty satisfied with the results.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is I just don't want to take a step backwards. So if we can get you, you know, 8 streams of basically the same data that you're getting now, then it should be relatively easy for you to adapt to process that. As opposed to if we gave you some data in a completely different format, then you'd have to try and figure out, rework the algorithm to use the new data, which might not necessarily be a good thing.
Yeah, because basically all we're looking for is in the A to D data stream is a 1 kilohertz tone, and we're trying to estimate its frequency. And if you give me that data stream, we're golden.
Well, I can't give you an analog data stream, but I can give you the I and Q data.
That would probably work even better, because that way I don't have to convert it. So yeah.
So the idea would be to give you what you would get at the second step in on your algorithm after you digitized everything and make it equivalent to that. And Bill, you know, we could have a special format of packets that would have data in whatever format those guys need to have, and it would be just a different stream type.
Yeah, I would think that the most regular form of information would be a known sample rate and a known center channel frequency and IQ complex samples. You know, maybe a slower sample rate or, you know, a particular frequency, but essentially not different from the other kind of information we provide, because then that's amenable to a number of different analysis tools and also recordable by each HTF.
Yeah, just as an aside, slower sample rates are better because you can deal with them. I mean, if we do a lot of the processing and decimation on the data engine, which is very efficient at doing that kind of thing, we can run more things at the same time on the SBC.
Couldn't we theoretically do some of the processing that they do in the SBC and create a special frequency deviation wave sample stream?
I think the idea behind the algorithm was to make the computation sufficiently efficient that the CPU can handle the computation. I'm worried about trying to put that in an FPGA and that it's going to be fairly complex and it's going to have feedback and if then else's and, you know, a few of those kind of things. And if the FPGA instead handles data in a regular format in a regular way, you know, maybe greater decimation than we sometimes use, or, you know, or something like that, but otherwise does the same kind of processing, then everything Bill does in terms of packaging it for HDF works in the same manner, even though they may have different sample rates. and downstream CPU utilities are still capable of processing it.
Yeah, yeah. I have to agree. The idea is, I mean, if we have some, if we have a data stream that has more detail in it, I can always do two things with it at once. I can always record it in a digital RF format and at the same time run it using the FLDigi frequency estimation algorithm and create a second data stream that we record, so we get both some of the detail as well as a post-processed or frequency analyzed output.
Yeah, you only get one output per second from the algorithm, so it's you're just, you know, spitting a floating point number every second, so it's not too horrible for I've actually got somebody here who started working on an FPGA implementation of that algorithm, but he got tied up teaching a course this semester, so it didn't get done yet.
Well, my intent wasn't to have the FPGA do something that the processor can do if it's easier for the processor to do, because, I mean, that's the whole idea of having an FPGA is to give it things to do that fit in the FPGA best and let the processor do what it does best. But if it could be something like mixing in another carrier, or, you know, making it somehow what I'm trying to say is that we can work on the algorithm later. And if we need a new format, and perhaps the new format is let the FPGA do everything and all it spits out is one floating point number every second. But maybe not. I don't know. I'm saying is that that's a possibility with our flexibility of formats, is that we could have it just give you a frame of 1 second samples.
Agreed. At this point, I don't have an FPGA in my design. I'm trying to let the processing be done on the Raspberry Pi, but I'm discovering probably time for a different discussion, but I'm running out of horsepower. We've been having pretty systematic crashes trying to do things in Python. The interpretive language for doing on-the-fly stuff just is not cutting it.
Well, I don't, you know, I think that's why it's called low-cost weather station, right? Because you're going to run into the headroom or the capability of the board, and the idea is you want to use as much of it as you can, but not more than what you have, because then it won't work. So if we can process the data in a certain way on the case version, and then logically proceed into something maybe quicker or less computational, so we can do more bands or something on the tangerine based one, then wouldn't that be a good dovetailing of the two designs?
Yeah, I agree. I think
completely agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, if what I envision is, I think we have the capacity to save the detailed spectrum plus or minus a hertz or two, save the actual IQ data plus or minus a hertz or two from the target frequency, and save that in digital RF format, and on the small board computer, and also run an algorithm that extracts from that what it thinks is a frequency estimate of the strongest signal. Now, we know that there's structure inside that data, and that will be available for post-processing for a second step that maybe happens in the central control system that looks at that the structure within that plus or minus a hertz or two. And we don't have to do all that on the small board computer. What you'd have is you'd have the small board computer doing the two things. It would save a chunk of spectrum so that for later, more detailed analysis, and it would do like what I would call a quick look to say, okay, boys, here's what we think is the strongest signal and what it's doing right at this moment. And then so you could have them both. I think we should be able to do both.
Well, so then if you're saying you don't have to process it in real time, so take the samples, go through, integrate or FFT it, look at the bin that you think it is, go back to your processes, say, oh, that wasn't the right one. And then you can just take the same data and go back and do it differently.
Well, not exactly that. What I'm saying is we save the data. We save the raw data, and we can upload that. And at the same time, we do a quick look. And then if we want to look at the detailed structure inside the IQ, we can do that later on the central system. We don't necessarily have to do it all in SBC.
I don't think that's going to be an option for the low-cost version, because I can't save data that fast to an SD card, especially if I'm trying to do four channels of it.
Well, John, I'm not suggesting that we necessarily have both systems be able to do the same thing. I'm just suggesting this is what I think we could do with the Tangerine.
I misunderstood you.
Yeah, this isn't taking the full speed data and storing that. It's doing analysis on the fly and storing just the very limited frequency bands, you know, a few hertz to either side of it.
Right, and you could take, so each frequency band is a very small amount of data compared to the whole spectrum, so even 9 slices of it is not really very much data.
Right, exactly. I think what John is saying is he's not in a position to save that spectrum data. The plan with the low-cost system, the only thing they want to save is the extracted data, which makes sense for that. It makes sense that we have two tiers of operation here. You want to get the more expensive system, you get more data. That's just, you get what you pay for.
Well, I'm glad that John's going to run out of horsepower, because otherwise nobody would bother to buy the Tangerine.
Scotty, you have no worries.
Well, you got your Mercedes and you got your Volkswagen. There you go.
That's right.
So I'm upgrading to a Volkswagen. Woo!
Well, as I've said to someone else, you know, if you have a Porsche, it's just a expensive Volkswagen.
Oh, I knew a guy in school when I was working at Motorola right out of school, he had a 914. And a buddy of mine used to call it the Volkswagen, and he used to get so mad.
Hey, I got a free ride in a Porsche 911 by making that argument.
Say, I want to jump in here and let John communicate with Dave Witten. They're both here and had questions today.
Oh, hello, David. I guess you've gotten approval from Nathaniel that I'm a real person. Is that true?
I think I've got the go ahead. Nathaniel will have to tell me differently if that's not correct. But both you and I believe David, I'm planning to go ahead and start assembling the kit kind of version of these things, because I do have prototype magnetometer support boards that I just haven't built up that I can provide. Keep in mind that these are likely not anything at all like the end product. That's beyond me now. But I give you the last version I have had, and what I've given Hyomin Kim to test, so we can all at least be comparing apples to apples.
Yeah, and Dave, I looked at your bill of materials and 0805 components. I'm perfectly comfortable assembling with those, so I'm happy.
Yeah. The one aggravation on the whole thing is the PCA 9615, which is, it's got an extremely fine pitch. And
yeah, it's an M-stop, and that's a bugger to solder by hand. But I've got a stereo microscope workstation that I do my work under, though, so I can actually handle that here, either here at home or at school, although school's closed down right now. I sort of started a firestorm this afternoon of emails. I apologize for that, because I'm trying to come up to speed on where I think I'm at, because I'm sort of coming into this at the 11th hour where Scotty's already got a lot of this work done for cabling and layout and communications and all that kind of stuff. And I'm still trying to figure out who I'm supposed to talk to for the hardware design. Is that Scotty or is that Bill or David? Are you handing that off? Or I'm enlighten me, I'm confused.
Well, I worked on getting these prototypes together to demonstrate that we could use the modules, or at least to evaluate these modules to find out what their capabilities were and whether they'd do what we needed them to do. As far as I'm concerned, that is been successful. And now I have personally, I'm not in a real good position to do any detailed analysis of what kinds of sensitivity and noise floors and so forth that we are dealing with. So I have to, I'm dependent on other people to test that, but I have handed the schematics and my project for this full scale board to Scotty, and he wants to, well, I don't know what he wants to do with it anymore, but he can do what he wants to do, and that's fine. Whatever Scotty has when the dust settles, I guess, is what we'll use. Now there is a smaller the design for the full magnetometer support board involves two boards. They're the same board, but it takes two of each one at the present, and one of them, the far one, the one that's out in the sticks, has the actual magnetometer module plugged into it. Both of them have the differential I squared C conversion and the power and the and each of them has an MCP 9808. Is that right? Temperature sensor for anything anyone wants to do with it. They didn't cost anything, and they were easy. As of now, the design is such, and the software I'm working on is for exercising these and fooling with them. But whether that's exactly the final version, I don't know. There is also a simpler version that I found very useful for just getting my bearings and for talking to one MCP 9808 and the magnetometer module that doesn't have the differential I squared C, and so can only be put however far you can reach with I squared C at 3.3 volts. Those have been very useful for testing. Two on a benchtop, I'm not going to have as part of the project at this point, my thinking is, because I want to be able to continue to make them and fiddle with them and hand them, give them away for free, whatever people need, only to good causes, of course. And I don't want to go through the elaborate process of having them manufactured. So that's a separate little deal. So the full-blown thing involves two boards, one local to the single-board computer, one remote. And that gives the distance between the two units that presumably is needed to lower noise floors and such. That's something nobody has yet completely investigated, compared, and may well require a quiet site to even be able to see the difference. I don't know. What I'm going to do is I'm going to get you and David at least the stuff to put those things together yourself. That one part has caused me to destroy about half the boards that I try to assemble. And so even with a microscope and so forth, I guess I'm just getting too arthritic and so forth. So anyway, that's the deal. I hope that makes sense.
I'll just say that's a 0.5 pitch part, which I have no problem soldering.
Yeah, with a little practice, they're not too bad. But so I guess what I need to do next is probably to get talk with Scotty about a schematic and the cabling and what was the size. Because I had started a discussion, I think, with Bill about the wire pairs in typical Cat 5 and Cat 6 cables. But it sounds like Scotty's got that already at least targeted.
Actually, I can provide you with most of that information. I just haven't had time to get it together. That was going to be in the stuff I was going to send you.
Oh, okay.
That works. If you look online on in our documents, there is a document for the magnetometer that gives the pinout of the RJ45 cable. And I think that, and I saw the discussion on the list about how we want to keep everything, I wouldn't forget what the word is, but all consistent. And I want to point out a couple of things real quick here. First of all, Dave Witten, what you do on the magnetometer stuff is yours. You the OHL, whatever we produce under OHL, in no way restricts your ability to produce, give out, change, do whatever you want with your design because it's yours. So what I would request on that front is that I'm going to take I'm going to mercilessly steal all of the valuable information that you've proven and put it into a board that we will productize with your permission. And it will be a parallel path, so it won't affect your boards at all. And I think if we keep the same cable pin out and if we keep the same I2C addresses, I think that all of our boards are going to be 100% compatible and they'll be able to be used interchangeably. So would that work for you, Dave?
Which Dave? Me?
Yes, Dave Witten, the designer of the current magnetometer boards.
Well, it's not ownership I'm worried about. It's just being able to work with them. But that'll do. That's perfect. The only caveat I would give is that document on that's the specification, so to speak, of the magnetometer hasn't been updated for a long, long time, simply because we've never finished some of the other interfaces, particularly to the DE, have never been completely settled, and it seemed things kept changing. So yes, but the part about the RJ45, the Cat6 cabling and all should be correct because Tom did it. So I'm sure it's right.
Well, but it's something that you used in the building of your board, so you built to that spec. So it might not be complete, but I think that what's in there is correct as far as the pinouts go. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, we don't end up cramping your ability to do whatever you think you want to do with your design. That was never our intent. So I just want to make that clear that I don't if it's going to encroach upon what you think is your area, I don't want to do it.
Well, I don't have any I have no other than supporting the folks on this project. I have nothing else in mind.
Yeah, my intent is to make what Scotty has compatible with the low-cost version so they're interchangeable, and possibly we could just do a larger production run and get the cost down. At least that's my intent. But there is a discussion I want to have with Scotty about the pinout of the twisted pairs on the Cat6 cable or the Cat5 cable, because there's some caveats there. And if we do it right, there's two flavors of it, and we can interchange them with no worries if we do something correctly.
Yeah. So if we can make it compatible with what we've already got, which I believe uses like 568B wiring, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, either the Cat5 or the Cat6 cables, but it's the orange, white, orange, and brown, white, brown pairs that always go on pins 1, 2, and 7, 8, respectively. And on the straight through cable or the crossover cable, those are always paired. And I was thinking of using those for the comm paths, and then 3, 4, 5, 6, which either have a flip so that you have the two blue ones in the center and they're surrounded by the green ones, or the straight through cable continues to have them. You know, there is a green pair and the blue pair. If those are interchanged for power, who cares? And that was really what my point was.
Well, Tom might want to jump in here too, but we agonized over the pinout for quite a while to try to make it as compatible as possible. So there's a reason why we picked those wires that we did. So I don't want to move away from that if we make a mistake and forget that.
Yeah. They two different flavors are just which color wires go on what pins, and as long as the connector is the same on both ends, it doesn't matter. You can use an A. If you use an A on both ends, everything's fine. If you use a B on both ends, everything's fine. The problem is when you try to put an A on one end and a B on the other end, that it's an issue. The pairing was picked with a couple of things in mind. One is to put the differential signals on twisted pairs so that you didn't split the pairs from a signaling point of view. And the second was to set up the power wiring so that if somebody accidentally plugged in a real honest-to-goodness Ethernet device at the tail end of the circuit, that the transformer on the Ethernet interface wouldn't try to short out the power from the magnetometer power sender module.
Okay. Because I know like I say, this is probably not a discussion for this meeting, but I want to come up to speed on how you made those decisions. But it sounds like you're still a step ahead of me and I need to catch up.
Yeah, there are specs on the Tangerine SDR.com website for the magnetometer, and it goes into the discussion in the document of how the pairs were picked.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, and the email thread that you started, John, I want to answer you with some kind of like my thoughts of how I want to take this forward, and to just to make everything work for the personal space weather station in an easy manner.
I'm all for it. Fire away.
But I think if we keep the cable, if we can agree on the cable pinout, which I hope we already have, but if we can keep the I2C addresses the same for the temperature sensor and the transceivers and the magnetometer, I don't think there's any issues with, Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave W., would that make everything interchangeable, right?
Yes, and you'd have to go out of your way to change them, except that I did have to put the MCP9808s at different addresses because it all on the same bus, and I didn't want them to collide. That's the only consideration there. And so I use 18 and 19 hex, one at the near end and one at the far end. I think the 19 is the near end.
Right, and that's just because while we only have one magnetometer, we might end up with, in the remote case, we might have two temperature sensors because they don't come off the board. So, yeah. But I think if we set it up that way so that like 18 is always the local one and 19 is the remote one, then I think we just look the same as your board.
I think that is exactly the direction I want to head in because I want to be compatible. I don't want to break anything. And the more we have in common that makes debugging and down the road costing and an interchangeability a piece of cake. And that's really the goal of this whole thing, is to make everything as compatible with everything else. And there's no reason to change it. So I'm all for that and fully support that. And that's going to be my marching directions. I want to be the same as you guys.
I wanted to mention real quick for both David and John, if you didn't see it in that long chain of emails today, I posted photographs of all the boards that Dave built and links to the PE&I source boards that were all part of what Dave worked on. So if you can find those links, you can actually see a picture of each of the boards, and you can see the commercial boards that are attached to them.
Yes, I did see those. Thank you very much. And it's my understanding that Dr. Kim is going to be doing an evaluation of that magnetometer versus a much more expensive version just to see how well it tracks. Is my understanding correct on that?
That's correct. It's a colleague, still a colleague of Nathaniel's. He's at the New Jersey Technical University, and they have magnetometers at Jenny Jump, and he was going to put this next or in some location near that and compare, but because of the COVID stuff, he's not been allowed to go into his office, so he can't work on it.
But I think David McGaw up at Dartmouth on 1HAC, I think he also has similar facilities, which it sounded like, David, you still do have access to, even with the whole COVID thing. Is that true?
Yes, I do have access. So we can see what we can establish.
Yeah, I also have, I'm considered a, what do they call it, necessary employee at the university. So I have actually a letter from the police department allowing me on campus. So I have access to the lab if I need to get into it. I should also mention that I purchased 10 of the, is it RM3100s from PNI out in California. I have those in my hot little hands. I'm planning on getting the code to talk to those as well as to the MCP-9808s. I'm also working with a, let's see, it's Troy and Frankie Bonte down in Columbus. I just sent them a Raspberry Pi, and they're actually collecting using my version of FL-Digi on their, they have a FTDX 1200 radio that they're actually collecting data with right now, even as we speak and playing around with that. So I've got them up and running with that. If there's anything you want me to do for the Mac, because I know they were complaining they had problems with the cable assembly. They couldn't get it the distance very far. If there's anything you want me to do to support them, Dave, please let me know. I'd be more than happy to do that for you.
Well, I hadn't given them one of these full, you know, extended versions of the system because I didn't have one. It was just taking me too long to build them, and I didn't have one at the time I last interacted with them. There is someone else, Julius. I'm not good. I'm not good with names. Who has worked with them with the original Spark Fun extenders and has been fooling around with all sorts of things and seems to have it working that way too. But those things have a different pinout and are not compatible with what we're doing exactly.
Julius Maddie.
Yeah, I think I had an email correspondence with him today as well. So I believe that's correct.
Yeah, he seems to be very interested and trying all sorts of things. But and I gave him one of the small boards, but he's doing a lot of measurements anyway.
Yeah, if there's anything I can do to help on that, please let me know. I'll be more than glad to do that. And one last question for Scotty: are you putting a 5-3-3 regulator on the remote board?
Yes.
Perfect. You answered all my questions. Thank you.
Okay, I have a question for Nathaniel that's sort of on this subject.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I read through your presentation. Looks very good, the status presentation. I did notice one thing. You have a lightning detector on the list of sensors. Is that something that we need to put on the Tangerine? Because I don't think it's in the spec.
Oh, that's leftover from a long time ago. Maybe I should delete that. So the short answer is no, you don't need to put it in. The long answer is if we eventually figure out how to put it in, I know Jerry Krieger would very much like that, but it's not required at this time.
Well, we actually built a sensor board with a lightning detector on it. So I have access to some of those parts, and I believe they're just I2C, so it would be easy to add it.
Did you use the AS the chip from the setup from is it Austria Microsystems or is it the other one? Evidently, they don't play nicely with other I2C boards. In some way, I don't know. They work great with SPI.
Okay, well, the AMS is what you're talking about, I think. Yes, that's the chip we used, and. We put it on a 5-sensor board, so I'll go back and, I mean, I designed it, but, you know, my brain is so fried right now, I don't remember what I did. So we had, we built basically an Arduino shield that had the 5 sensors on it. So we had a lightning sensor, we had a 6-axis magnetometer, We had a that was a magnetometer and accelerometer all in one case. We had a temperature sensor. We had a humidity sensor. It was five sensors that we put all in one little hat board. So I can go back and take a look at that, see what we did, whether we put it on its own separate bus, because I do remember when we were debugging that, we had some difficulty with it. So I have to go back and check our notes and see what we did. Anyway, I don't know how cheap that sensor is, but it could be that we could if it's I2C and we can make it work reasonably well, we could put it on the magnetometer, or we could have a separate board for it, whichever. Or we could just, if it's cheap enough, we could just put it down on the data engine and make it a separate SPI or I2C bus, and that would take care of the having it not play well with others.
Yeah, I mean, if we can put it on feasibly at a reasonable cost, and if it's effective, then I would say do it.
Yeah, the question, I guess, is if we put it on the data engine and we put it in a box, is it going to really, are you going to get enough? Because, I mean, it relies on like 500 kilohertz spectrum to see.
Could you talk to Jerry Krieger about this?
Yes, I can do that.
Yeah, I think he would know. I think he would have a lot to say, and I would only be guessing.
You could probably also hook up, design it in such a way you could run an external antenna to it to make your 500 kilohertz reception more effective.
Yeah, what we did on our sensor board, if I remember right, is we used a big fat inductor as our antenna pickup.
Yeah, I have a device I got actually at the Orlando Hamfest, which it does lightning detection, but it also has a chip in it that will look for a certain signature that can be observed coming out of tornadoes. Tornadoes create a recognizable RF signature, and so it will alarm if it detects a certain amount of lightning or if it detects a tornado signature. And so I think they, looking at the board, It uses a big fat inductor with some kind of a slug in it.
Well, you heard of the chain or the rock weather detector, right?
I know a weather rock.
Yeah, the weather rock. So it's got a sign in front. It's a rock hanging on a chain. And it says, here's how you tell the weather. If the rock is cold, then it's cold out. If the rock is hot, it's sunny outside. If the rock is wet, it's raining outside. If the rock is missing, then it's a tornado.
Well, if the rock is missing, well, maybe it's stolen, depending upon the neighborhood you're in.
I like
that.
Yeah,
that's true. I can tell you, when I was at Virginia Tech, they have a National Weather Service on campus, and I went to an open house there one time, and they actually had an official United States National Weather Service weather rock on the premises.
Ooh.
It was fully calibrated.
I'll bet it was inside, though.
No, they had it outside.
Say, FYI, we are half an hour past our time.
We're just having such a good discussion, Dave.
Yeah, the classic joke about the National Weather Service is they have no windows. This is actually true in a number of their offices.
So they can't. They have to go outside to see what the weather is?
No, they rely on instruments.
It's a true scientist, then.
We lost our NWS station at our local airport after, not too long after it got hit by a tornado that they didn't announce. I don't know that was connected, but they somehow failed to see this one coming. It was too close.
Was that the one a few years ago that trashed the airport?
Didn't trash this airport. Maybe there was one in St. Louis. That was a different. Yeah, but there was one here in this was a long time ago in Columbia.
Oh, sorry, I forgot. That's right. I keep thinking, since you're Mel's evil twin, that you're in St. Louis, but you're not.
No, but evil all the same.
Okay, good.
Are we done here? From your
channel. Well, I'm done here anyway. I know it's been great. And anybody have anything else?
I think that's about it. Although, Scotty, are you still interested in guest lecturing at all?
Oh, I'm still really interested, but, you know, I'm afraid that I'm not going to have time, so I don't want to commit to something I can't do.
Very fair. I appreciate that.
But let me look at it again. It seems like I have a week or two, because you have, what, like 3 more weeks of classes? So I have maybe 1 more week to come up with a secret plan.
Yeah, and I mean, it doesn't have to be absolutely crazy, but I mean, if you could give... The way I see it, FPGAs are a very important part of communication systems these days. And if you could give them a good overview, like a 45-minute overview, I mean... You probably could do that right off the top of your head.
Yeah, okay. Well, if I can get my head above the water long enough to do that, I could record something and send it to you and see if that would meet your requirements.
That sounds good. Or really, you could just do the class live.
Well, might be a good idea, because I still have to have a PowerPoint deck or something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you do a PowerPoint deck or something, but... You know, don't worry about recording it ahead of time. You just do it live, and then people can ask you questions at the end, and we can record it, you know, through Zoom. So I can send you the video file when it's all done.
Yeah, it's just that some of this stuff that I was supposed to be all done with last week has come back to surface again, and it's I'm not making as much progress on the fun stuff as I wanted to, so I'm jammed up.
Well, don't worry about it then. I will be fine, you know, regardless, like it'll be totally fine. And certainly these other things take precedence, but if you wanted to and you were able to, the offer is still there.
Okay. Thanks, Nathaniel. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. Well, I think I am going to head to sleep tonight. This has been great fun, and thank you very much.
Thank you all. And I'll be heading out.
Thank you, and 7-3 to everybody.